Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Replacement Level Podcast. I'm Ross Carey. Thanks for listening. Thrilled to be joined right now by Ken Davidoff. Ken is a national baseball writer for the New York Post and a voting member for the Baseball Hall of Fame. You can give Ken a follow on Twitter at Ken Davidoff. Ken, thanks so much for taking the time to join the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Ross.
Well, Ken, let's start at the beginning, I guess. Tell me what initially attracted you to baseball in the first place.
Oh, well, I grew up in New Jersey. Baseball was my favorite sport to play and watch, and I knew very early on I would not be a professional ball player, but I did love to write about baseball. So from the time I was 7 years old, this is what I wanted to do.
Since you started writing and have been writing professionally, how have you found that journalism, and sports journalism in particular, has changed?
Oh, good Lord. It's changed dramatically from the time I started professionally in terms of the news cycle, going from a standard newspaper to the 24/7 world of Twitter and blogging and breaking news online. I think the entire culture has changed, both within journalism and in terms of the relationship between journalists and their subjects. I think it's been a profound evolution.
That relationship between journalists and their subjects, particularly with sports, is a fascinating evolution as well. At one point, reporters were often covering up or seemed to help players when there were negative stories. You never heard about the personal lives. You never heard about any negative stories. Athletes now are just like celebrities. There's tabloid reporting on their personal lives, their marriages, what they do off the field. That makes the paper all the time, and I think that is a significant shift that caused strained relationships over the last 30 years between how athletes and reporters engage with each other.
I would agree, Ross. Yeah, there's definitely look, in some ways, I think it's positive. I think back in the day, well before I was doing this, the writers would travel on the team plane and see things, and the agreement was you could travel on the team plane, but you can't write what you see. I think we're better off without that arrangement. But certainly, I'm not positive that professional athletes' personal lives should be covered to the extent that they are. I'm don't really get involved with that aspect too much. And yeah, that has made things more difficult for folks like me.
I want to shift over to PEDs. I want to talk about how performance-enhancing drugs were covered, or not covered, in Major League Baseball during the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. So let's start with, when was the first time you heard of a baseball player using steroids?
Specifically?
Yeah, do you know?
I mean, there were rumblings, for sure, about certain players. I started covering baseball full-time in the late 90s, and yeah, at that time there were whispers and suspicions and all that, but I think the first confirmation was probably Ken Caminiti in 2002.
I think the steroid era, who knows where we want to mark that. If we want to say 20 years and go from 86 to 2005, that seems reasonable, but it certainly was peaking after the strike, really, in 95 to 2003 is when it's peaked. So you came in right sort of in the peak there. Looking back in hindsight, would you say that the BBWAA and not just the writers, but the broadcasters and all of the journalists involved failed at covering the story?
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. Yeah, I think there should have been more awareness. Having said that, it wouldn't have been kosher to just start lobbing specific accusations at people. You need evidence.
That's right.
And a guy's looking big and putting up big numbers is not sufficient evidence to start lobbing personal accusations.
That's absolutely correct. But it is enough evidence for some to keep Jeff Bagwell out of the Hall of Fame.
Well, I thought we were traveling 95 on North, and North 95, you just slammed on the brakes and took us on 90 West.
and the double standard there in this case is appalling as well. When you think about writers, they can never just print something without any hard evidence. They can never just claim that a player used steroids without any significant evidence against the player. But the writers do use that same standard, standards that they would never be allowed to print. They use to omit players from the Hall of Fame. It seems a little ridiculous. It seems more than a little ridiculous to me.
Ross, I agree with you 100%. I'm troubled that this came up most recently with the Roger Clemens trial. There seems to be the attitude by some, that there's this sense of pride that, oh, the Hall of Fame is not a court of law. Our standards are lower. the burden of proof is not as high, as if this is something to boast about. And I feel very strongly the opposite. I agree with you. And Jeff Bagwell, do I think he used steroids? It wouldn't shock me in the least if he used steroids. But there is not sufficient evidence, in my opinion, to indict him. And personally, I don't care if he did, because they were not illegal in baseball at that time.
That's right. And you look at someone like Clemens. I personally think he used steroids. I think McNamee is a little tough to believe, is a general person. His character isn't great, but he's been proven to be truthful among the other players that he accused, that he said that he used or provided steroids with. Plus, the DNA evidence on the syringe is enough to make me think that Clemens is guilty. However, if Clemens is innocent, what could he have done differently? He's denied it from the beginning. He's denied it from the start. He went to court. He went in front of Congress. He didn't have to testify in front of Congress. He volunteered to testify in front of Congress. What could he have done differently if he didn't use?
You're preaching to the choir, Ross. That's exactly the line I've used in other interviews. I'm cynical by nature, and one of my lines is guilty people have a right to defend charges also. You know, guilty people have a right to go for it and try to get vindicated, and he was. When the Mitch report first came out, you can look it up. There were certain people, certain media pundit types, who said, all right, tough guy. You know, if you're really telling the truth, then raise your right hand and go in front of Congress and say it. And Roger Clemens said, okay, I will, and he did. He called everyone's bluff. It was heroic on a certain level. Unbelievable cojones to do what he did. And he prevailed. He won.
And there are so many flaws to the Mitchell report that this is somehow used as the official document of who was and wasn't using is embarrassing. George Mitchell was directly affiliated with the Boston Red Sox. There's a conflict of interest right at the start. They ignored the Dominican connection, which, quite frankly, is quite large with steroid use. It just seemed like Bud Selig ordered this report to try and use a few players as scapegoats and deflect any attention away from himself.
Well, to be more specific, I think he was looking to get Congress off baseball's back. And imagine you're trying to please some people and you're preparing a festive gourmet meal. So what's the first thing you do? You hire a celebrity chef, and that would be George Mitchell. They go, ooh, George Mitchell. You know, he's a huge name on Capitol Hill. Good job, bud. You hired George Mitchell. Now you need an entree. The entree is Roger Clemens. Oh, my goodness, Roger Clemens. That's terrific. He used steroids? That's great. This is terrific. And then you need to surround it with some side dishes. Andy Pettit, that's great. Good job getting him. You know, Mo Vaughn, okay, he hasn't played in a few years. That's a good name. Kevin Brown, it was a perfect list from Major League Baseball's perspective because it was not any young, productive superstar players. It was all older players, some of whom had already retired. And it served MLB's purposes, and it succeeded in getting Congress off MLB's back.
Ken, at one point, you did not vote for players like Rafael Palmeiro and Mark McGwire. You have since switched and have started voting for Palmeiro and McGwire. Tell me why you made the switch.
Well, those two guys are two different cases, so if it's okay, I'll go one at a time. Mark McGwire, I think he was on my very first ballot, which I think would have been December of 06 I got that ballot. And I voted no, because I believe he used. I thought his testimony in Congress was damning enough, and then Tom Davis, who ran those hearings, confirmed that McGwire offered to testify, to be truthful and say, I used, but he wanted to be protected legally, and Davis said, no, I won't protect you. And then Davis threw McGwire under the bus and admitted that publicly. So I voted no. And what happened was, just seeing the evolution over the next few years, the A-Rod, that was one big moment for me. I felt embarrassed to be part of this fist-shaking moral majority. I wasn't comfortable with that. Derek Jeter, at the same time, came out and said, we didn't all use. We didn't all use, so don't say we all used. And then it just kind of hit me, like, I'm not getting you off the hook, Derek. It's your problem. You know, you were part of the union. You guys didn't do anything to stop this, so I'm not going to bail you out. So that was another turning point for me as I approached this. And then the third point was my buddy, Mike Vaccaro, now my teammate, at the New York Post. He came out with a book, the First Fall Classic, in which he detailed how prominent gambling was in baseball at the start of the 20th century. And just contemplating that and the sanctity of our statistics, it's just laughable to talk about that. We have no idea how much the early stats were impacted by gambling and by people fixing games and throwing games and all that. So to shake your fist now and talk about the sanctity of the stats, I just couldn't play that game anymore. So I started voting for McGwire. I believe in the, it was definitely in the December 2009 ballot. That's when I voted for him for the last 3 years now and plan to continue to do so. Rafael Palmeiro is a different case for me because Rafael Palmeiro committed his crime, quote unquote, at a time when the baseball players and the owner said, all right, you know, now we're going to start tracking this stuff. Now there will be consequences if you use this stuff. And Rafael Palmeiro failed his drug test and received the suspension in 2005, and there's a price to be paid for that. Now, the first year he was on the ballot, which I think would have been December of 2010, I did not include him on the ballot because of the failed drug test and because I had 10 other candidates I liked better. This past year, December of 2011, I included him basically because I had room. So the way I've described guys who failed drug tests, and the two most obvious guys would be Palmeiro and Manny Ramirez, I find it damaging but not disqualifying. So now that the ballot's going to be flooded with all the new names coming up this December, I think it's quite likely I'll have Palmeiro off my ballot once again because he failed the drug test.
And it's interesting, there are also two different cases talking about Palmeiro and McGuire because McGuire was dominant at a stretch of time. McGuire was one of the best players in baseball. Palmeiro was never dominant. He was a very good player and a very good hitter for 15 years, but never had a stretch of true dominance. There are different cases as well. And I know that there are some writers who try and claim that Mark McGuire isn't a Hall of Famer, that he's not a Hall of Famer. They're not even taking the PEDs into consideration, but they don't consider him a Hall of Famer. They're kidding themselves if that's the case. McGuire is an obvious Hall of Famer just looking at his numbers. If you take his numbers at face value, no one in the history of baseball has numbers like that that's not in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I agree. I think you can make somewhat of a case for him not being a Hall of Famer, regardless of the illegal PEDs. But obviously I vote for him, so I agree with you more than I disagree with you. I'll also say you talk about Palmeiro versus McGuire. I'm not a peak guy. A lot of voters are very much into the peak player's peak. I don't care. I just look at the final numbers. Either you got there or you didn't. And to me, if you got there, then you were dominant at some level. I mean, Rafael Palmeiro was a dominant hitter in the major leagues. He might not have been top 1%, but he was certainly top 2%.
That's fair. I mean, he's certainly dominant compared to your average major leaguer, certainly to a replacement level player, but compared to other Hall of Famers and to his contemporaries who would be considered for the Hall of Fame, I still think he falls a little bit short. But certainly he's one of those borderline cases. It's certainly not like voting for Jay Bell.
No, he's much better than Jay Bell.
How do players like that end up on the ballot?
Well, there's a committee. There's a committee that decides who winds up in the ballot in the first place. That's a committee of Baseball Writers Association of America members. And let's face it, it's an honor for many players to get on the ballot in the first place. And you could argue that some players deserve to get on the ballot and don't, and some players don't deserve to get on the ballot and do. And I'm talking about Lenny Harris, of course. That's an interesting discussion within itself.
One of the things that drives me crazy is that no one's ever gotten in with 100%. And now that's become a thing. Babe Ruth didn't get in with 100%, and if Ted Williams didn't get in with 100%, and if Willie Mays couldn't get in with 100%, no one will. But it seems like to me, if you're like next year, Greg Maddux is on the ballot. And if you're not going to vote for Greg Maddux, you're basically telling the Hall of Fame that your vote means nothing.
I guess I don't feel as strongly about that as you do. Certainly Greg Maddux should get 100%. I can't wait to see the explanations people offer for not voting for him, but I would be very surprised if he indeed got 100%.
You mentioned something about the crowded ballot earlier. I think you can make a legitimate case for 15 guys on the ballot. You're only allowed to vote for 10. What's the reasoning behind that?
History. History, that's just the precedent. I couldn't tell you the origin of that. It's before my time, but that's been that way for a very long time, a maximum of 10.
When you get the packet from the Hall of Fame, what kind of stats do they provide you with?
I don't really look. I do the research on my own, baseballreference.com, mostly. It's pretty cursory. I think it's a paragraph each. I think they've added on-base percentage and slugging percentage in recent years, but they're certainly not going to provide the depth or breadth of stats that you can find on baseballreference.com.
Now that you have been voting for several years, what changes would you make to the process?
I don't know personally if I would make any changes. Look, there are picks I disagreed with. There have been years when I voted for 8 or 9 guys and one player got in. I didn't vote for that player. Jim Rice, his last year, I switched from yes to no on him and just in time for him to get in without my help. Andre Dawson was another guy I switched from yes to no, and he got in. So I'm sort of reverse good luck for some of these guys. But I, you know, look, I mean, if you get 75% support of, I think it's about 600 voters, I think all in all, that's pretty fair, even when I disagree, even when I'm part of the 25% that didn't vote for him.
Do you think that you need 600 people determining who's a Hall of Famer?
I don't really care, you know. If the Hall of Fame decides to go some other route, that's their prerogative.
Well, that sounds perfectly reasonable. I wish that the Hall of Fame would make every vote public. And I wish that they would ask for an accompanied written case either for or against a player. No one's asking for lengthy biographies of a player. Just simply, what Hall of Famers did you compare him to? What contemporaries did you compare to? What numbers did you look at? We're talking about a paragraph or two, and make those cases public as well. I think if ever all the votes were made public and all the votes were accompanied by a written explanation of that decision, I think that would go a long way.
I agree with you. And then, as I'm sure you know, I know you know, you have my stuff, and some voters voluntarily do that. I do that. And frankly, it's good for business. I mean, I get some of my best web hits of the year when I annually publish my ballot.
This year, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Mike Piazza, Sammy Sosa are all coming on the ballot, along with two other deserving Hall of Famers in Biggio and Schilling, who have never been associated with PEDs in any way. What will your ballot look like this year? Do you intend to vote for Barry Bonds?
Yeah, I certainly intend to vote for Bonds and Clemens. I want to scrutinize the numbers a little more closely with the other guys, but to me, those two are slam dunks.
Neither one is going to get in this year. I think that's made pretty clear. There's a significant portion of the voters that have essentially taken a vow to never vote for anyone who is associated with PEDs. Why is it the baseball writers or the voters' responsibility to punish players?
Well, that's the right the Baseball Hall of Fame has given the baseball writers. So I think you have to ask the Baseball Hall of Fame that.
I feel like that's such a creepy thing. I really think that the baseball writers sort of coming across as moral authorities, I think that's a problem. I think that, you know, look, Bill Conlin was honored by the Hall of Fame, and he's an accused pedophile, and he's judging people on their morality. I think that's wrong. I think that certainly he's not a fair representation, but he is a member. There's plenty of people with DUIs and spousal abuse who are voting as well. To judge moral character, the idea of writers punishing players, it makes me cringe. I'm just appalled by it.
I think that's very fair.
People yell at me when I say this, but what Pete Rose did is so much worse than what these steroid guys did. And at least the punishment for Rose is coming from the right place. It's coming from Major League Baseball.
Yeah, and I agree with you 100%. I always say Rose was a felony and the steroids guys were misdemeanors. My one objection is I don't like how Major League Baseball, I think technically it's the Hall of Fame, took Rose off the ballot. I think Rose should have been on the ballot and let the chips fall where they may. I certainly would have voted for Rose because I think what he did was horrible. But I don't like that they took that right away.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier about numbers being distorted, because people say two things and it's two different arguments, really. One argument against keeping the PED guys out is that they're cheaters and the cheaters shouldn't be in. Of course, that argument is not valid because so many guys in history are in the Hall of Fame who have cheated, who have gone against the rules of baseball. The separate argument there is that the numbers were distorted, or that the numbers are not valid. Nothing distorted the numbers in the history of baseball, like the exclusion of black players for over 50 years. The segregated numbers are ridiculous. You look at all these numbers that the players put up in the 20s and the 1910, you look at every career number with the exception of home runs. It's dominated by players of a different time and a different era. When it comes to those players, the attitude seems to be, well, that's just the way things were, and people move on. No one thinks the books are tainted. We still cling to the past in baseball. Many of us still think Babe Ruth is the best player of all time. He played in the 1920s. But when it comes to modern-day accomplishments or modern-day achievements, when it comes to players that use steroids, and there were many of them, including many great players and Hall of Fame players who use steroids, people look at that as like it's the worst thing in the history of baseball, that nothing has distorted numbers more. And I just don't see that as adding up.
Yeah, once again, Ross, you're preaching to the choir. I always, you know, I have steroids arguments with people, and I love having steroids arguments with people. I always say, well, choose a lane for me. What's your lane? Is your lane moral or is it statistical? Because I'll destroy you either way, but just let me know. And when it comes to the statistical, yeah, we just don't, you know, it's easy to point at Barry Bonds and the 73 home runs and McGuire and the 70 and Sammy Sosa and the 66. But we just don't know how much they were distorted. What we do know is that every number ever put together, compiled in baseball, has context, has historical context, has its own taint, if you will. You mentioned the Babe. Look, Roger Maris, first expansion year ever, 1961. So the pitching was watered down like it never had been before. You know, different ballparks. Hank Aaron played in the launching pad in Atlanta. Every number has its own taint. So to get all fired up about the numbers of the steroids era, when you can't tell me, you can't possibly give me a mathematical equation for how many more home runs Barry Bonds has because he used steroids, then to me you're kind of shaking your fist at the air.
Let's talk about the guys who haven't been associated with PEDs. Let's talk about people like Tim Raines and Alan Trammell. Advanced numbers help those guys a lot, but that's one of those things where conventional numbers seems to help them as well. Even the sniff test would tell you that Raines and Trammell were two of the best players of the 80s, and numbers support that. Why do you think those two have failed to garner much support from the voters?
You know, just anecdotally, speaking to other writers and reading other writers' opinions, it seems to me both of them suffer by comparison to their contemporaries who were just superb. Tim Raines, I'm obviously talking about Ricky Henderson, who's arguably the greatest leadoff hitter in history. And then Trammell, Ozzie Smith and Cal Ripken Jr. and Robin Yount. So it was a very shortstop-rich era there. And I think, they both had interesting careers. They both had sort of non-traditional careers where Raines was just a stud for about a 10-year period, and then he lingered for another 10. And to me, he needed those lingering years. He was a helpful player. I covered him with the Yankees in the mid to late 90s, a helpful player, but obviously not a superstar player anymore at that point. Trammell, if you look, he had some interesting dips in his career. He didn't have an outstanding 10-year run where every year was elite. He had some real speed bumps. And I think that, too, can impact people's perception of him.
Let's talk about this year's ballot. What do you do with Sosa?
I don't know. The one intriguing thing for me with Sammy Sosa is he was caught corking his bat. I, again, we talked about guilty beyond a reasonable doubt or innocent until proven guilty. And Sammy is innocent until proven guilty on the steroid stuff. But he was caught corking his bat. And that is cheating, undoubtedly. He was suspended for it. So, you know, is that the equivalent of busting Al Capone on tax evasion? Do you keep Sammy out for that, knowing that he probably did a lot worse? Just something to contemplate. But I don't know yet what I'd do with Sammy.
It seems like with people that the corked bats and the spitballs, nobody cares. I think that's part of, and you know, you're probably going to think I'm crazy here, but I really believe this, that I think that the voters have a bias against modern players. And I think that the steroid era has only made that significantly worse. I think it's there even without steroids. When you look at someone like Fred McGriff, who is a borderline candidate, but still, if you look throughout the history of the game at how many first basemen have numbers better than Fred McGriff, it's zero that aren't in the Hall of Fame, rather. So I wonder if Fred McGriff had just simply been born 15 years earlier, how much different his numbers would look, and if he would just already have been in, and not only been in, but seen the same way we look at someone like Willie McCovey. Because of the relationship, we talked about this earlier, that the writers have now with players, where it's a lot of in-your-face, and because of the 24-hour news cycle, and there's a lot of personal stuff that gets written about players, and players are a part of this too, where players now come into the league as multimillionaires, they get huge signing bonuses, they're arrogant, they can be rude, they can be obnoxious. It's created a strain where I think people still romanticize the past, especially the golden years of the 60s with Mays and Mantle and Aaron, and I really think that modern-day players are judged more harshly.
Would you mind if I blew up everything you just said?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I don't see that at all with Fred McGriff. I think Fred McGriff has a reputation as one of the better guys. I think it's very unfair to say that this generation of players is more arrogant or entitled or anything. I like a lot of players who are playing right now, a lot of good guys. I think Fred McGriff isn't in because of the evolution and revolution in statistical analysis. That's why I think he isn't. That's why I don't vote for him, because now you look and say, all right, he's almost there. But, you know, let's remember he was a first baseman, and therefore the bar is raised for what a first baseman has to do offensively compared to an Alan Trammell or a Roberto Alomar. So that's why I don't vote for him. And I think in the past, as you mentioned, oh, okay, this guy had 493 home runs, he's in, without even thinking about what position he played and what sort of value he provided. with that position. So that's my take on Fred McGriff.
Well, it's interesting about McGriff, and I understand that McGriff is a borderline case as well. I was thinking about this the other day in terms of what player, at least in terms of a Hall of Fame caliber player, was perhaps most negatively affected by the steroid era. And I think it might be Fred McGriff. From 1987 to 1994, 43 players in all of baseball had an OPS of 800 or higher. 16 were at 850 or higher. Fred McGriff in that time was at 931, which was second in baseball only to Barry Bonds. His OPS plus was 153, which was second in baseball only to Barry Bonds. Nine players in all of baseball from 1987 to 1994 hit 200 home runs or more. One hit more than 250. That was Fred McGriff. Here's the appalling number. Nine players in baseball, 200 or more, that's from 87 to 94, hit more than 200 home runs. From 1995 to 2002, 35 players hit 200 or more home runs, 14 hit 250, including 5 over 300 and 1 over 400, who was Sammy Sosa.
Yeah, well, I guess I have two thoughts. The first thought is, again, going back to what I said, positional value. As a first baseman, the bar is raised. It's that simple. He's not bringing anything to the party defensively, really. So that's why the bar is raised for him. And second of all, if he actually didn't use, and my sense is he did not, not my problem. Not my problem that his union proceeded on the path that it did. It's not my job to play retroactive, selective judge and sheriff and deal with that.
Do you blame the clean players more than you blame the players that used?
I don't blame anyone. It is what it is. I don't really care. But yeah, I mean, certainly when, as I noted earlier, when Derek Jeter whined that we didn't all do it, my thought was, well, don't look to me for pity. You know, you were a high-profile player. You could have said something and tried to impact things, but you made the decision you did, and you know, you can look, tip of the hat to the guy. He signed a bunch of endorsement deals. He hosted Saturday Night Live. That's his prerogative, but you don't get to whine retroactively.
Yeah, I don't understand why Major League Baseball didn't, especially during the strike when they were negotiating for a new CBA and things were at their worst. Why don't they just hold a press conference and say, one of the things we're fighting for is drug testing. We believe that steroids have invaded the game. It's become more pervasive than any of you may think. We think it's at all levels of the game, both in the majors, minors, college, even in high school. We want testing now. I feel like if they had done that, that would have forced coverage from the writers. It would have become a big story. It probably would have gone to Congress in 1995, but it would have been resolved by 1996. Major League Baseball failed. Even the clean players who, during the time, who've since been very vocal, people like Frank Thomas and Curt Schilling and Derek Jeter, those guys are all-star, superstar-level players. If they had just held a press conference, what about before the All-Star game when every media member is there and just said, hey, we think this is going on. We'd like to have testing. They don't have to name a name or a teammate. People would have gone crazy if they just held a press conference saying, we think steroids are a part of the game and we need testing. No one did anything. This retroactive, oh, well, we're going to punish you now, just seems so fraudulent.
A couple points. I think in 1994, you know, there were no records broken yet. I think it was a little early. I think a lot of people honestly did not appreciate how pervasive steroids had become. So I don't think it's fair to say, oh, they should have done it right there and then. And second of all, they had bigger fish to fry. You know, they had canceled the World Series. They were just trying to get back on the field. They certainly weren't going to start going to town on drug testing.
What do you think the earliest mark was where testing could have come into play, where baseball knew, the players started to know what was going on? And obviously, it's guesswork here. When do you think that something could have been done? Do you think 98?
No, I think 98 was the tipping point, undoubtedly. When McGuire and Sosa broke Roger Maris's record, and then Andro gets spotted in McGuire's locker, then I think it's like, all right, something's going on here. You know, and you look at the body changes he and Sammy underwent. I think that's your tipping point.
But at this point going forward, the PED guys aren't getting in. There's a clogged ballot full of these guys. You look at someone like A-Rod, whose career is obviously, without question, Hall of Fame worthy. A-Rod's still playing for 6 more years, and then he's got 15 years of this on the ballot. When does this get resolved? Will this get resolved by then, or are these guys just going to linger or fall off the ballot? Do you think anyone's going to get in before then? What's the resolution point here?
Yeah, I don't really see a resolution point, Russ. A-Rod has a contract 2017. Then there's a 5-year waiting period, so he would start on the ballot on the class of 2023. So as you mentioned, it's a 15-year wait. So I think in 2037 is about when we'll wind things up, and maybe even beyond that. because of Ryan Braun. I think Ryan, you know, already some people have decided that Ryan Braun is an Hall of Famer, even though he technically did nothing wrong. You know, he prevailed on his legal argument. So you could argue that it's 20 years after Ryan Braun retires. So yeah, look, it's very, very hard to project that far ahead. But based on where things are now, I really don't think any of these guys are going to get in. I'll accept Braun from that. I don't see A-Rod getting in at this point.
The Braun thing is so ridiculous. If you were Ryan Braun and were accused of using steroids, what would you have done differently?
Yeah, it was brilliant. His strategy was brilliant. And, you know, people say, it was a technicality. It doesn't matter. You win or you lose. It doesn't matter how you play the game. You win or you lose, and he won.
You've been listening to Ken Davidoff. Ken is a national baseball writer for the New York Post and a voting member for the Baseball Hall of Fame. You can give Ken a follow on Twitter at Ken Davidoff. Ken, thanks so much for joining the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Ross.
All right. Thanks again to Ken for taking the time to join the podcast. Really appreciate him doing so. Unlike the first guest, Bob Ryan, Ken and I have similar views on how these players should be perceived and how they should be treated in terms of their Hall of Fame candidacies. Bob Ryan and I didn't agree on anything, but Ken Davidoff and I did. I want to thank a few more people before I wrap things up entirely. I want to thank my friend Zach Milliken. Zach is a graphics designer and a web designer. Zach really helped me get my websites, rosscarey.com and replacementlevelpodcast.com, up and running from the start. He continues to help with some of the day-to-day maintenance and overall look and feel of the sites. So if you're interested in graphics design or in web design, you're looking for someone to follow on Twitter, you can give Zach a follow at ZachDM, ZACKDM, and check out his websites PaintedX.com and DesignTypes.tv. Also want to thank two bands for letting me use their music. Thanks to Baker for letting me use the song Reputation in the opening theme. And thanks to Scamper for letting me use their song Barcelona, which is playing right now. You can find out more information on both of those bands on MySpace Music. Thanks again for listening to the Replacement Level Podcast. The next episode will feature Jim Callis from Baseball America.